From theheart.org radio, you are listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein.
Well, welcome to another episode of Click and Rub. I'm here with my colleague, Eric Topol, and this is Paul Tierstein. And I think we're going to talk today about evidence-based medicine. And lately, Eric, at our weekly cardiology conferences and other conversations we have about patients, you've been critical of evidence-based medicine. And I thought this was surprising coming from you, given your long history of trying to collect grade A evidence. So try to explain what your argument against evidence-based medicine is these days.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It's kind of evidence-shmevidence. I think I've just spent too many years trying to collect evidence that doesn't really hold up very well. It's for several reasons. I mean, one of the big issues is that we were testing, for example, drugs that would work on a whole population and looking for some benefit at 15%, 20% reduction relative, absolute reductions that were, you know, oftentimes 1%, one out of 100 benefit. So this evidence of helping people is really modest at best. And it's very disappointing. And that's the so-called randomized, you know, controlled, rigorous trial type evidence. The other big issue, of course, is we don't have that kind of evidence for most things that we do. And unfortunately, we then wind up with this eminence-based medicine.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear you say that because the 1% absolute reduction has always bothered me because the number needed to treat them is 100 or sometimes more than that, I should say, and you just wonder what the real benefit is to the therapy. The other problem that I'm having with a lot of recent trials is the overinterpretation of the trial. And just because it's a big trial, it's expensive, and because it's got a p-value that's significant, gets overinterpreted. What was the quote? A p-value is not a substitute for a brain.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Mason Soans used to say, if it needs a p-value, it ain't worth showing. Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, you take these trials, and my favorite one is the COURAGE trial. It's overinterpreted into meaning that you don't need to do coronary angiograms, and people forget that everyone got a coronary angiogram to get in the trial, and the process of getting into the trial really excluded patients who might die. Anybody who was that sick that had anatomy that the doctor worried about whether or not they would survive with it didn't get randomized in the trial, or I would say for the most part didn't get randomized in the trial, and they shouldn't have gotten randomized in the trial because it's not ethical unless the doctor really has equipoise. So then you have this trial that's really enrolling low-risk patients, and then you come to the conclusion that, well, the intervention doesn't affect mortality, yet the patients weren't really at risk for death.
It's the wrong model of trying to do trials for the mass population, mass medicine, and then you have such little benefit that you can claim, attach some kind of statistical significance, but it isn't really clinically meaningful, and it's a waste. I mean, with us spending in the drug side, now when you talk about the device side, $300 billion a year for drugs, most of them are misfiring, that is, they're not working, or they might even be inducing side effects, with little evidence, then there's something wrong with this picture. We're not particularizing the intervention with the patient. That really needs so much work.
Well, before we really get too critical, we should point out that there's been some incredibly wonderful trials that have really impacted medicine, and you've been involved with a lot of them. We just had the partner trial that out. You know, that's just an amazing trial, right? The number needed to treat is 4. You get to save one life.
Yeah, the only problem there, Paul, is you got these 90-plus-year-old people. And what are you doing here? How are we going to keep them going with the new stent valve for another X number of years?
Well, you know, I feel really strongly about this. And you know what? I'd like to take you upstairs right now and introduce you to one of them because these people are so vibrant. They are so wonderful.
I know, but we're going down the toilet here on the economy, and the trial evidence is extraordinary, and it's very unusual to see that. I'm just saying that is, you know, from a societal point of view.
I spend a lot of money taking care of a lot of young patients, and if you told me who I'd rather see live and who I think is more worthy of life, some of the young patients I treat versus the 98-year-old that we did 2 days ago, Val, that we worked on. First of all, I think she's got a lot of longevity. You know, she's the type that can live well into her hundreds. And plus, you know, she's adding value.
Well, you know, you're getting back to a central point of mine, is that it does need to be individually determined. And you know, that's part of the reason why these large mass trials have a problem. I'm not saying it's not appropriate to use TAVI in a 90-plus-year-old person who isn't a candidate for surgery, that evidence is really strong for that. But I'm just saying it's coming at a bad time.
Well, that's for sure. Let's go back to trial design for just a second and tell us what we should do if it's not these mega randomized trials. Is it going to be pharmacogenetics? Tell me what the answer is.
Now, I'd like to see really small trials targeting the biology. The cancer world has got it so much ahead of our heart world, where, you know, if you have malignant melanoma, you have a BRAF mutation, you get a drug that blocks that particular mutated gene, you get 80-some percent responsiveness. And if you don't have that gene, which most people with melanoma have, you actually get worse with that drug. And that's
okay, but you can get tissue in cancer, right?
Isn't you only need 20 patients, 30 patients, you know, to prove everything. And that's the exemplar. We need to find those sorts of things. And none of these 10,000 patient trials, 40,000 patient, this is crazy. I mean, you know, we can't develop drugs like this, because even when you claim they work, they really don't work in the vast majority, 90-some percent of people. That's an issue, but the design of trials has to be really shook up. But again, I want to go back to the fact that most evidence that we say evidence-based practice isn't have nothing to do with the trials. It's to do with the guidelines and these people that sit around the room and, you know, the eminent ones, and they make these decisions, these judgments, evidence-based medicine. And that's just crazy because, like, I'll give you an example. When they revamped antibiotics for endocarditis prophylaxis, this is crazy. Where did this come from?
That was level of evidence C. Maybe we should just exclude that level. It's hard. Do you really want to exclude level of evidence C completely from the guidelines? Probably not.
I want to get rid of guidelines.
How about the other thing? Well, the guidelines get overinterpreted, and of course they can be interpreted in legal situations too. What about appropriateness of care? I think that's a scandal.
Perfect, because statins are used now to judge whether or not we're giving appropriate care as cardiologists, right? And just this week of November 9th, you know, there's this Lancet paper of 170,000 people,
with
26 randomized trials. Now, most people who get statins, they don't even have coronary disease or any vascular disease.
Right.
And the amount of benefit that they get, I mean, you know, there's this new site called the NNT.com. I don't know if you looked at it yet, but it's pretty wild. Because the trade-off for people without coronary disease who take a statin is basically the same as inducing diabetes. Now, that isn't even mentioned in this CTT thing, and the actual benefit, we're talking about 0.3%, 0.04%. You know, it's tiny, tiny benefit, and you got to have 100,000 people show it. So I've got a problem with this, you know. And I'm going to be evaluated as appropriate and a quality of care by me. I decide this patient, I don't want to give a statin after discussing with the patient about their risk.
The argument against your position there would be, well, if you documented in the chart that you had that discussion and that the patient really wasn't going to benefit enough and didn't want it, then you'd be kind of released from that particular requirement, that patient, on your report card. But it's a lot of work. I mean, it's a lot of time, effort. You know, I'd rather spend the money on TAVI for old patients than the money on collecting data about whether or not we're prescribing statins. Because the truth is that, you know, at least in our cardiology division, we get our report cards. The number's always between 70 and 85% for individual physicians, and there's always very good reasons. The doctors here, they're not forgetting to prescribe statins. They just have reasons that aren't captured, or the data is not captured. They have a blood test in front of them that's on a piece of paper that's not in the computer, and so the reviewer doesn't capture it. It's a lot of money. There's just a lot of time and money being placed on evaluating us, and I think it's going to get worse.
I don't think it really contributes to it.
It doesn't help anybody. Nobody's
right,
getting
but it's all an outgrowth of this evidence-based medicine era where the evidence is not so great, and then the downstream consequences are great.
I mean, healthcare reform is, of course, going to just make us worse, right?
Exactly. Now we have these accountable care organizations which are going to emphasize this sort of thing. And it's worrisome, actually, because it's probably going to amplify this whole problem.
What I would like to do is spend some time collecting data on all the things that each of us do all day long that don't contribute to the health of anybody.
Right.
The amount of time that we spend.
You know,
filling out forms, signing things.
Yeah, it's increasing. It's increasing.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we can't use that time to be better educated about, you know, the new things and the exciting things and the science and all the good stuff.
All right, so we don't want to just complain. This whole session sounds like we're just complaining. So let me just ask you to educate us on one more thing that I found interesting, the concept of the N-of-1 trial.
Yep.
You don't like the big trials. How do you about the N-of-1 trials? People don't really know what they are. So tell us what they are, and I'll tell you.
I'm into the N-of-1. Yeah. That's really where we need to head. Pendulum needs to swing in that direction. So in any given individual, where we can define them at the granular and molecular level, we can test an intervention until we get it right. And then we say we succeeded in the N-of-1. And so let's say it's a blood pressure thing. In a way, we kind of do that in the empirical clinical sense.
Right.
But instead of doing, you know, 30,000 patient trial to check out a blood pressure drug, we would do a series of N of ones where we're matching up, you know, a particular hypothesis of, you know, let's say it's a gene variant, or let's say it's continuous blood pressure monitoring through wireless. And we basically, by getting so much more information on that one person, that person is having tremendous information that is derived per individual, rather than the whole flip side. The opposite of that is mass medicine. You know,
okay, so it's not, just so I understand, it's not randomized.
No.
It could be randomized, I suppose, but it's not going to be blinded. That's
right. It could be blinded, but the main point is you keep working on the one individual that you're defining at a much more, you know, granular level.
Yeah, but now you're collecting data
until you get it right.
Do you take 50 individual data and put them together?
You could. I mean, the point is, let's say you're using a continuous blood pressure wireless monitor and you're checking an antihypertensive drug, and now you have so much more data on each person.
Okay.
And if, let's say, you have this new drug that's supposed to be the greatest way to treat blood pressure, and you treat 20 people, and those 20 people, you've converted every moment of their life into normal tension. That's pretty good.
That's pretty solid, yeah.
Okay. And then all of a sudden, you've got, you know, a series of N of ones, and then the only thing you haven't really answered is, you got to check safety in a much larger population because you're not going to get that. But for efficacy, N of one is a really nice model, particularly when you can understand that individual in ways that we haven't previously done that, whether it's physiologic, imaging, biology, or some combination of all of them.
Interesting. You know, I think most cardiologists, they haven't even heard the phrase.
It's been around a long time, but it's starting to make a little comeback. The FDA is interested. Obviously, you know, developing any new device or drug has been much more challenging in recent years. The regulatory challenges are overwhelming. So this is getting a relook, and it may, now that we can define any individual so much more, you know, in high D, that would be an opportunity that's worth pursuing, at least until we, you know, try it out.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think we've taken the discussion from away from 100,000 patient trials down to single patient trials.
right.
I think you're going to save us all a lot of money with this new plan of yours.
And we're getting rid of guidelines, getting rid of eminence-based medicine.
And getting rid of the people doing the report carding for us.
That would be good. Yeah. Yeah, we're cutting costs here. We've got a new form of healthcare and a new form of research and development. I hope to see at least some of it in the years ahead.
Thank you for saving the economy, Eric, with your new plan.
Well, I'm sorry to go backwards on what you expected me to be, you know, the proponent of the randomized clinical trial. But the way it has been for too many years now, decades, it's time for a shakeup.
We'll see if this has any impact. But my guess is we're going to still see some big randomized trials, probably some of them even coming out of your department.
I'm not going to comment on that because I'm not going to try to do any of those. Yeah.
All right, well, it's an interesting conversation.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
You've been listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein on the Heart.org radio, sharing ideas and opinions with the cardiology community worldwide. Find out more on the Heart.org.